Member Frederick Prane led a move to increase the harvest limit to just 3.
My rationale is that, I guess it's the conservative side, if you put optics on this, the perception is that we have a lot of information we need to gather.
Prane says he wants to know more about the overall biomass or fish population in the lake and how the DNR resolves ongoing concerns with commercial anglers. The board went along with Prane on a 4-3 vote. The rule will also expand the lake trout season from 7 months to year-round in most of the Wisconsin portion of Lake Michigan. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
8:10, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. Let's check sports and weather. NBA, Bucks lose to New Orleans. Bulls beat Utah. Both teams are off tonight. NFL, Thursday night football, Denver at Indianapolis. NHL, Blackhawks on the road. They skate in Winnipeg. Now the forecast from the National Weather Service, sunny, breezy, and cold today. A high of 26. This morning it is sunny, wind is from the northwest at 8, 13 degrees, wind chill is zero. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient eating and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack and Drea. 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's great to welcome Nan Calvert back into our program. She visits us once a month to bring to the table a important issue related to the environment. And typically brings along with her a very interesting guest or two, and she certainly has done that today. Although, Nan, it's probably interesting to say that this is a guest that you've actually never met before this morning, I think.
That is true. I've never met Todd before, but I'm happy to have made his acquaintance. What I think is funny is that you know Todd and didn't know you know Todd until a few days ago.
And now we all know each other.
I was laughing because Todd is drinking from a canned water for kids water bottle, and that leads us back to Joan Rory, who was here a few months ago. So, you know, as I say, what do I always say, Greg?
We're all connected.
It's all connected, that's right.
2 degrees of Racine and Kenosha separation.
Yeah. Something like that. So we are welcoming into our studios today Todd Brennan, who is with the Alliance for the Great Lakes. He is their watershed project manager. And so we're going to be talking about, and actually it's interesting, Nan, how often the topic of the Great Lakes and fresh water come up even in the course of conversations that are ostensibly about another topic.
Exactly. We live in a very, very special place in North America. We live so close to the Great Lakes, very large collection of freshwater bodies. And with climate change and droughts and all kinds of things happening, it's extremely important for us to remember that, you know, these are finite bodies of water, and we have to do what we can do to protect them and preserve them for future generations and also current generations. And we have so many wonderful people in southeastern Wisconsin who are working on our waterways, like Alliance for the Great Lakes. So that's why we're here today.
Excellent. So Todd Brennan, first of all, let's find out a little bit about where you are from originally and a little bit about your life's path that ultimately took you into this this line of work. So where are you from originally?
Originally, between Massachusetts and Kansas. I grew up split between those two places, and so started in Massachusetts, was born there, lived there until I was about 10, moved to Kansas, and I can think of, you know, not a starker change in sort of a young person's reality.
Yeah.
But eventually I moved back to Massachusetts, so I have to kind of say those two places because they both took a very formative part in my life.
Interesting. So at what point did you start to become interested in the environment, and at what point specifically did your focus begin to be on things like the water?
Yeah, well, I actually know the exact moment that it happened, and then it was probably just built upon a life's work of experience. But when I was probably about 11, I think I moved back to Massachusetts. We went back to Massachusetts to visit my grandmother, who lived in Cape Cod and lived down by the shore. And my dad and I went fishing and caught a shark. And I remember looking down at that shark and everybody else kind of freaking out. And it just sort of, there was an instant moment before like chaos ensued where I looked at it and it just sort of rolled over and smiled at me, so to speak, in a shark way. And it just, that was it. It captivated me. And I was fascinated when I looked down into the water and saw this big blue blob sort of moving about and just wondering, what is that? What is that thing that's going to come up out of the depths? And when it was a shark, it just, that became even cooler. And at that moment, I said, okay, I want to know what that thing's about. I want to protect it. And that evolved. And for, you know, my entire educational career, I was very focused on marine biology and actually explored that and did that for years. But then it shifted. And eventually, I find myself in the Great Lakes without sharks, but equally fascinating of a system. And I can't get enough of it.
Right. So you studied marine biology in college, for instance?
Yep. Yeah.
And were you able, it sounds like you maybe professionally did something with that for a time?
Yeah. So I was on the East Coast doing fisheries management, working for the National Marine Fisheries Service. I encountered sharks. I wasn't necessarily studying sharks. And then I volunteered my time with different shark research experts. One of the guys, Greg Skolmel now, you'll see regularly on the Shark Channel or on the Discovery Channel. So it's kind of neat to have that experience. And then did some stuff with fisheries and aquaculture and eventually got into experiential education, especially out of Woods Hole. There's a series of tall ships that do studies, and they take other college students out to do research and to experience just sort of that lifestyle. So I got involved in that and then got hooked on education. And then that's what ultimately brought me to Milwaukee, because there was a ship there named the Dennis Sullivan that does experiential education, both science and sort of life skills. And I literally immigrated to Milwaukee by boat. That was my first time stepping ashore in Wisconsin. Huh. And that was about 13 years ago.
Wow. So at what point did you become part of the Alliance for the Great Lakes? Or was that already in the mix for you?
Right. So maybe I'll even roll it back. That's another story. My first experience of Lake Michigan was by boat. And I had gone asleep the night before as we were sailing through the inland seas, which was just fascinating to me. And I woke up in the early morning, and my first laying of eyes on Lake Michigan, I was sort of wiping the sleep out of my eyes, and I noticed just there was thousands, if not tens of thousands, of little dead fish. And I was just struck by this. And so me being the scientist on board and the educator, I got out a net, and I'm sweeping them up, and I'm trying to identify what these fish are. And the best closest I could get was they were an Atlantic herring. And I was so confused, like, what's an Atlantic herring doing dead by the tens of thousands in the middle of Lake Michigan? And an old timer walked by me and he's like, oh, those are alewives, son. And I'm like, okay, but why are they dead? You know, why are they everywhere? And he's just like, oh, that's just what happens this time of year. And I remember being so struck with the cavalierness of, that's just what happens. Like these, thousands of these fish died. And so right then I was enamored with the fact that you could at the same time sail for days across this inland sea landscape, but at the same time, this is a system that's it's got serious issues. And I was both captivated and fascinated and then scared. So that shifted me to action. And not long after that, I got engaged with, I was still working for the Discovery World and the Dennis Sullivan, but I can engage with the Alliance for the Great Lakes because they had an education curriculum. And so I wanted to know more about what it meant to, you know, activate people to be aware of this. And then eventually I left that job and moved within the Alliance to do that, to really work with people to protect this amazing inland sea system.
Fantastic. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with, not just Todd Brennan, but also Nan Calvert. But let's say primarily, we're both, Nan and I are both excited to have in our studios today for the first time, Todd Brennan, who is with the Alliance for the Great Lakes. He is their watershed project manager. And at some point in the hour, we'll start untying exactly what that means and exactly the position. But I think it's important for us to maybe get a good, strong overview of really everything that the Alliance for the Great Lakes does. How long has the organization been in existence, and is it headquartered in Milwaukee?
No, so 47 years, which is, if those people who are aware of policy and the way that environmental policies come along in the nation, same amount of time as the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. So The Alliance kind of came out of that period of time, that period of turmoil where Cuyahoga River was catching on fire. People were finding even bigger masses of alewives washing ashore along the beaches, which is an invasive species in and of itself. So it's like two issues in one. And so 47 years ago, we came into being as a small effort, part of a group of people in Chicago primarily, working to engage people around this issue and wake people up to the need for better policies, better protection, better awareness. And that founded the Lake Michigan Federation. And then about pretty much just before I came on board, maybe about 15 years ago, I want to say, don't hold me to that, but about 15 years ago, we became the Alliance for the Great Lakes when we realized there didn't seem to be a concerted effort across the Great Lakes. And the reality is Lake Michigan is those other lakes. I mean, they're all interflowing aggregates of lakes. So we became the Alliance for the Great Lakes.
And so in other words,
in Chicago.
So it's a mistake, in other words, to think about each of those lakes in too isolated a term. I mean, especially when you're thinking about the well-being of one, you have to think about the well-being of all of them.
The last point is probably a great way to think of it. That said, we do still, each lake has its own dynamics. As the EPA puts, we have a Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement that's an agreement between us and Canada. So each lake is sort of taken in and of themselves in terms of strategy and actions that are needed because they're different dynamics. But what affects typically one lake very soon will ultimately affect all of them. So that's how our scope grew.
Mm-hmm. So what is your specific task as watershed project manager?
Well, just to keep all my hats and wear them regularly. So for me, my work kind of splits up into it's hard to explain. I guess the easiest way I try to explain it is I try to get people to think like a watershed. So when you're in your community, whether you're a community leader or a business leader or a farmer, how are your actions going to affect some aggregation of impact down the road, or maybe even right in your backyard? And what that plays out to look like for me is primarily in three bins, sort of education, engaging people, making sure they're at the table, we have good representation, and then planning to implement the work, getting people to prioritize the Great Lakes. And for me, a lot of that work falls into nutrient reductions, and then policies, sort of being ever aware and pushing for protective policies for the Great Lakes. For me here in Wisconsin, that primarily is I watchdog and make myself aware and try to push for the right policies. And then once we get the right policies in place, how do you implement them? How do you make sure that they're actually hitting the ground? They are what we expect. No policy is going to solve all the problems, and they create, in some cases, just as many complexities as we would not hope for. So you need just as much effort and diligent attention to trying to get people to be aware of why we have the policy and implement it. So those are kind of the three bins of my work.
Who are the entities that are putting forth policies for the Great Lakes region?
As Great Lakes as a region, there would be us, the Alliance for the Great Lakes, in terms of lawmakers make the policies, but we can help advise or inform them. We don't get as many opportunities, I'd say, in this day and age as we used to with being able to just sort of inform policy from the ground up. It's a lot of defense lately, a lot of time spent trying to maintain the good policies we have and not allow unprotective policies put in place. But the Alliance for the Great Lakes, the National Fish and Wildlife Federation is a partner that we work with quite a bit. Freshwater Futures is another partner that has a foothold in both Canada and the United States. So it's a good, they're a good group that has a good perspective for that. The Great Lakes St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, where John Dickert now, regular citizen, has moved on to the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, which is a group of mayors protecting the Great Lakes. There's probably more, but I'm forgetting. But those are the ones that come right to the forefront of my mind.
It brings to mind the complexity on just a political level of the fact that you have all of these. I mean, in a sense, part of the question is, who do the Great Lakes belong to? And who has a sort of official jurisdiction over them? And how can you get various mayors and governors and national representatives and state houses working together for a common goal? And I should think some of what's happened involving the Great Lakes of a more positive nature, at least positive from your perspective, are kind of a remarkable achievement when you think about that.
Yeah, there's a lot to pat ourselves on the back about right now, and that's an important tenet of my perspective on this work, is to not be afraid to count your victories along the way, no matter how small they are or large. It doesn't, for me at least, it doesn't mean that I'm still not eyes on the prize. That one of the goals for me too is just to get communities to envision a greater future that's out there, to not be bogged down in what you can only imagine as, you know, the existence right now, but that it can be better. And so to be a cheerleader is really important. And so, you know, we have a lot of things to be thankful for in terms of overall. We've gotten point source pollution, so this is stuff that comes out of industries plants pretty well, at least controlled, so to speak. There's a whole process around the Clean Water Act to do that. You've got innovation that has come from that in terms of the way technology gets spurred to handle some of those problems. We are doing a little bit better, I'd say, in sort of the way that we handle fertilizers, nutrient pollution, except non-point source pollution. So the stuff that comes from you can't point to exactly where it comes from. We just know it comes from a landscape, whether that's farm fields or streets or golf courses. That still needs a good deal more protection. And then invasive species in the same way. That's something that's just ever present. And invasive species have a mind of their own, and they're always three steps ahead of us. So that needs constant attention. But I'd also say people seem to be able to show that they care and they're interested more. I have plenty of stories of people who said their parents turned them away from the lakes, you know, when they went down and they wanted to go swimming, which is what a kid naturally wants to do in life. You want to go to that big body of water and you want to jump in. And plenty of people who from, you know, several decades ago who said their parents, you know, shunned that. And now we have an undoing of that. We've got parents and grandparents who are now bringing their kids back to the lakes and facing the lakes and saying, no, this should be clean. And so hopefully we get a foothold with that no, this should be clean. That's about changing those expectations and envisioning a better future. You know, there's plenty of people out there right now that will just scoff at the idea of jumping in the river, right? The Root River and the Milwaukee River. And the question I ask is, why shouldn't we? Mm. So hopefully that's envisioning a greater future.
Right. I mean, even if it means today we shouldn't, but we should be able to.
We should be able to.
And maybe someday we can, if that river gets cleaned up, at least in the way that progress has been made on the Great Lakes. Let's talk for a moment about how clean the water of the Great Lakes is, particularly in comparison to the way it once was back a few decades ago, when I remember that everybody talked about Lake Erie essentially being dead. The level of pollution there was of such a high level, and I suppose the other Great Lakes maybe weren't all that far behind in that respect. compared to the state of the lakes back then, I realize you weren't doing this work back then, but what kind of progress have we made, again, in terms of the water itself?
Well, yeah, it's ever evolving. And you say Lake Erie, for example, it's a victim and a benefactor of its own capacity, in that when you look back and, you know, you had the Cuyahoga River catching on fire, which feeds Lake Erie, and you had Lake Erie essentially being biologically considered dead. Those were worse days, by all means. And then we went through a period where we actually started to control a number of the issues that were primarily point source pollution that was and the phosphorus that was coming out of our own home systems in terms of the type of soaps we use. We've been able to, you know, sort of get tighter restrictions on some of those, you know, garden variety store-bought, so to speak, sources of pollution coming out of the wastewater treatment facilities and out of the industries. And you saw the response in Lake Erie. It sort of cleaned itself up. The beauty for Lake Erie is it's the smallest of the lakes. It's the shallowest of the lakes. So it can clean itself up the fastest. Then things shifted, right? And we, as you know, farmers are often want to say, we're trying to feed the world. And what comes out of that is you have aggressive tactics in terms of farming, and as well as you have suburban landscapes that expand and have more streets, and those streets lead to the waterways. You end up having sort of it's an ever evolving onslaught back onto the environment. And as a result of some of the policies and the practices that we do upward of the landscape, we end up having these issues show back up in Lake Erie. So it's once again not able to assimilate those nutrients. And I shouldn't just say, I use Lake Erie as an example. It is the most prominent example, but we don't have to look very far, both here in the Root River, but also Green Bay. So there's three algae bloom hotspots in the Great Lakes, and those are Western Lake Erie, Saginaw Bay in Michigan, which is in the Little Finger, and then in our Little Finger, west of Door County, that's Green Bay. And Green Bay is has a horrific issue with algae every year, and I spend probably 60% of my time trying to see what we can do to solve that problem.
So in other words, it has too much algae or the wrong kind of algae or both?
Yeah, so that's another good question. This the way that this plays out along our shorelines, especially our shoreline, which is kind of a sheer shoreline, and we don't have shallow bays and, you know, quiet waterways. Generally, it just blends into a pretty deep lake, pretty quick, pretty well diluted. So the way the phosphorus gets trapped along that shoreline, you end up growing more algae that's called cladophora, which is kind of like a stringy mass that kind of grows up towards the sun and it sits on the bottom. And anytime you get a disturbance in the waves, it breaks free and then it washes ashore and it's ugly and it's stinky and it's nasty. And one day you'll go down to the beach and it looks great, smells great. The next day, literally overnight, boom, you can have, you know, 10-foot mats of this stuff, and it can just sit there and rot and stink. And people usually think it's sewage or they think something else. So that's more of an aesthetic impairment. It can lead to enhanced bacteria traps along the shoreline. So that has its own issue. It's ugly. It makes people want to turn away from the lake. Luckily, we in Racine haven't been plagued with that as much as some of the other communities surrounding us. Then the other type of algae is what happens in some of these more shallow water systems, such as like the western shoreline of Lake Erie and as well as Green Bay, where you have these blooms of blue-green algae, which is a very simple type of bacteria-algae hybrid. And for whatever reason that we're still not quite sure of, when you get them in larger masses, and that means either sometimes looking at the water and it's bright green and you look like you can't even penetrate it, or it could be not even visible. There's algae in there, but you don't see it. Either way, you can have a release of microtoxins, which is a microcystin is one of those type of molecules, and it is very harmful for us. It's a neurotoxin. So whether you're a dog that goes plunging into the water to swim and drink, it could make them sick or kill, and the same thing can happen to people. And it comes with its own issues with it can affect the skin, and so you can come out with severe rash and itching. And that usually happens, for example, in Green Bay, Western Lake Erie. If that wasn't bad enough, if I didn't scare you enough there, that huge massive algae that grows like a film across the surface of that water system, let's say Green Bay, for example, when it dies, and it will die because it dies and regenerates regularly, you know, on a daily basis, it will sink, you know, further down in the watershed, and then bacteria do what they do. They decompose it, but they take the oxygen out of the water in the process of doing that, release carbon dioxide, and you get basically essentially a dead zone. So there's huge swaths in Lake Erie and in Green Bay that there's just a complete lack of oxygen. And what we know is it's growing in size and extent and length. That's the alarming thing that we're seeing. And so that's what we really try to focus on so that we can ultimately not have that happening in the future. And this could be all one of the – this could be one of those victories that we're looking to talk about 20 years down the road.
Right. And did I hear you say that we are a little bit mystified in terms of exactly what is going on here, or does it make perfect sense? I mean, maybe the growth of it is a little mystifying, but otherwise – does it sort of make sense that this is happening? And is this in any way man-made? I mean, is does this have something to do with what we're doing that we need to stop doing?
Yep, that's a great question. It is man-made, and we do know what we need to do to stop it. It's the doing of that maybe gets in the way sometimes. So the only mystery that I was referring to is the why for some reason this type of algae releases this toxin. It is a natural aspect, but because there's so much of it in one place, there's naturally a concentration of that toxin. So there then it becomes our problem, right? Okay. We're the ones that have concentrated this huge amount of nutrients that caused this big bloom in the algae. And by the way, then the algae says, look, I got something else for you. So they throw up this toxin. So that's still a mystery why that happens naturally. But when it comes to the source being the nutrient, so primarily in freshwater systems, it's phosphorus. Nitrogen's also a factor, but nitrogen is more of an impactor in saltwater systems. So that's why in the Mississippi River, you hear more about nitrogen, because ultimately that's all going down and affecting the Gulf. And nitrogen's an issue because it can affect your drinking water as well. Phosphorus is a limiting nutrient, meaning that's what the type of algae we have in the freshwater systems is looking for. That's its food. That's its junk food, really. That's what it wants to thrive on. And then the drinking water aspect is when you get too much of it and you get the algae, then you could get these toxins, and people, it can be entrained into the taken up into the water systems that we have. And that happened in 2014. It's happened a number of times, but in Western Lake Erie, for example, the biggest one we know about was in 2014, when the entire city of Toledo had its fresh water shut down. So for 3 days, 500,000 people went without water. And the issue, as you mentioned, is it's in most places, it's at least half to not a good deal more to do with the way that we're treating the land, especially for agricultural production. And then another aspect is the way that we're treating our land in the city. So the way that people are treating their lawns, whether it's excessive use of fertilizers that wash into the street, even just the grass clippings, right? Because once you fertilize the lawn, then the grass grows, and then all those grass clippings now just sort of hold that same amount of fertilizer. So when you sweep them into the street and they go down the drain, I think people think that magically goes somewhere magic. Instead, it just goes right down into your local waterway. So for me, I live right along Lake Michigan, and so I know, I've tracked it. I know exactly where my water goes, and it goes directly down to the beach and the shoreline where I like to bring my kids to enjoy. And so for me, it's just a constant reminder of, like, what I do in my landscape matters. And so these are decisions people can make. So it is definitely within our grasp. And in some cases, especially with agriculture, that system needs some support and some help, because – We didn't get here overnight. So people have been doing, and they've been sort of building into this, especially in terms of agriculture, for multiple generations. So you kind of usually start with what your dad taught you, and then you evolve, and maybe you evolve further, or maybe you don't. And so there's some risk there viewed by farmers often that, well, I'm going to lose out, right? Because everybody else is doing this. So if you want me to do that, well, then there's going to be a cost, a transaction cost to that. So to some degree that we can sort of help with that risk cost or the risk factor. And then just giving these guys an opportunity to learn and learn from one another, that's pretty critical. So we didn't get here overnight. We're probably not going to get out of this overnight, but we could be making decisions. I always tell people, we don't have to wait for policies. We don't wait for anything. You can make a decision tomorrow.
Right. So is it that we're using more fertilizer? That is, I'm thinking particularly farmers. I'm assuming that's the more acute cause of this, but people in their lawns too. Are we using more of it, or are we using the wrong kind,
right,
or both?
Yeah, it's both, and also the power of the land to handle that. We've got onto this system of agriculture that's so high productive that really people are mostly focused on yields when it comes to corn. So, you know, if I know that my corn needs this much phosphorus in order for nitrogen in both cases to get the yields I want, I'm going to give it to them because the cost of what I will get out of it actually outweighs the cost of the input. And I don't really want to debate it. I don't want to think about it. And I don't want to worry about the factors that the seasonality and every year is kind of different. So it's a high productive system. And as a result, we've sort of stripped the land of its ability to sort of assimilate that. Even worse, you're trying to get every penny, as this whole system sort of races towards the bottom, you're getting every penny. So where you used to naturally see stubble, at least out there, you'd only take, you know, 80% of the corn stock. Now you see guys just ripping out the entire corn stock bound to bare ground. And there's nothing good that can come from bare ground. Anybody who's ever spent any amount of time dealing with their lawn knows that bare ground stinks. And so now you see a lot of bare ground because we've worked our way towards that, trying to get every last penny out of the land. And so whether it's fertilizer or manure in some cases, because we're a big dairy state, there is phosphorus being loaded into the system in terms of fertilizer so that they try to tightly control the application. But we naturally have a phosphorus-rich soil. So the soil itself acts like that. And then it gets into the plants, and then it gets into the manure. Then we reapply the manure. And if we're growing as a dairy, we have too much manure oftentimes, and then it's not just an asset, it's this thing you're trying to get rid of, this manure, and so you will apply it in the wrong ways or excessively, whether and maybe without thought to how close that is to a stream or what kind of grade you have. So it's all those things, but probably the real key ingredient in terms of twisting that or shifting that is how we treat the land, thinking about soil health. That's become a big buzzword, and it's a nice buzzword too, because you don't have to talk about water quality naturally. Water quality just hugely benefits when you start thinking about soil health. So for farmers to focus on, is my land of high quality such that I'm more resilient, so that when as the weather comes and goes, I don't have to worry as much about the type of inputs I'm putting in. The land will actually do a good amount of this work for me. So that's the balance we're trying to strike. But for a lot of guys, it's kind of going back to basics, but going back to basics is still sort of a shift in innovation for us.
And so one of the missions of the Alliance for the Great Lakes, I assume, is to educate farmers on what you've just been talking about and to encourage them one way or another to adopt healthier practices for their land.
Yes, and this has taken the shape for me primarily just because we can't be everywhere. And I'm 1.5 to 2.5 people here in Wisconsin. I have a consultant that I work with in partnership with the University of Wisconsin Green Bay that sort of represents us up in Lake Erie, and her job is agricultural outreach coordinator. So as I manage her work and we work together, she does a lot of different things, but you know, at the end of the day, her job is to try to see what we can do to bring more farmers into the fold and work with that. And then down here in southeastern Wisconsin, I don't do as much of that, but I do support people that do, such as Dave Giordano of Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, who does a fantastic job. And if we could only duplicate both Dave and Allison at Root Pike Wynn, we could have them knocking on all those doors. But right now, they're pushing themselves to the max, just simply trying to get out there and work with as many farmers that are coming to their door. And they've been very proactive to that. But now the response is good, but that kind of maximizes their time. And so then you really fall back on making sure that the other entities, agencies, organizations that are within, especially the state and federal government, so the conservation departments locally in the county, as well as the National Resource Conservation Service agents. These are the guys who come from the Farm Bill with armed with tools to help you. So to improve soil health, to reduce your inputs, to increase your yields, while at the same time reducing your, you know, the things that that are costing you money by treating the land better. So whether that's cover crops, so these are crops that you grow in between your feed and cash crops, or no-till system. So that's meaning, you know, you look out at a lot of farm fields still and you just see, you know, plowed dirt every spring and sometimes in the fall. There's a whole type of farming where you don't even have to touch it, right? And that costs less time, costs less money, costs less fuel. And but it does cost some equipment upgrades, right? You have to change the way that you either knife in the manure, or change the way your planter works. And that's, you know, that's usually a capital cost that a farmer, you know, wants to know is a good investment. So it takes groups like this and people like us to make sure that we're all pulling in the same direction. Because I just sprayed out a number of different organizations and agencies for you. One of the keys is to make sure, are we all pulling in the same direction? And that's a big part of the work that I do, especially up in Green Bay. It's to say, okay, what is sort of our collective approach to this? Do we have our eyes on the same prize? And can we get there? Do we have the same vision? And then are we engaging all the right people around this, right? Just focusing on the farmer is very powerful because of the source, but the reality is there's people who are feeling it downstream, and then there's business leaders who are going to wonder how the money's being spent, and then there's political leaders stuck between all that, saying, okay, you guys tell me who to listen to. And hopefully it could be, well, listen to all of us because here's our one voice.
There you go. We should spend a couple minutes at least talking about the situation of invasive species in the Great Lakes, and that this is, of course, a point of real significance, and it's one of those vexing problems that never goes away. What kind of progress can you report?
Well, sadly, not enough. It's not my area of expertise, so I'll start off with that. So I'm reporting what I'm just aware of that a number of my colleagues work on, and it falls upon two issues, and one is most notable around here because it's close to home, but that's Asian carp coming out of the Chicago waterway system, which connects to the Illinois and Des Plaines River, which ultimately connect to the Mississippi River, and that's the source of that invasive species. Hopefully, you know, being halted right there at the Chicago waterway system. The status of that was after years and years of trying to get the federal government to address this issue because of its jurisdiction and the way this the way the Chicago waterway system works. It's got it's a diversion out of the Great Lakes. It's an approved diversion that's 100-year-old based upon a Supreme Court consent decree that actually reverses the flow. So that right there makes it, this is the purview of the federal government. This is the Army Corps of Engineers. They really need to dive into this, and we need federal investment in this, especially since, you know, the one party that would be most affected is the shipping industry. There's sort of a small barge system and cargo system on that part of the waterway that transfers cargo from the Great Lakes Basin to Mississippi and vice versa. But they're heavily subsidized, too. That's a heavily subsidized industry. So it begs the question for the federal government to be involved. And so the Army Corps of Engineers, we pushed for years to have them do an extensive study. And then we pushed and successfully got them to accelerate that study. Originally, they wanted that to be like a 15-year process. And then we got that narrowed down to a several-year process. And now that study is done, and it's called the Brandon Road Study, because there's an area of the Chicago waterway system where there's literally Brandon Road, and that's the lock. That's considered the sort of ecological choke point for this organism. So we wanted to study what are the best options. And right now in place, we do have some electrical barriers, but they're not enough. We already know that. We've had a number of tests. So they can do tests of the water to reveal the DNA as well as larval eggs and of the Asian carp. And we found them beyond these barriers. And then this last summer, even in June, we found a fish beyond the barrier. It was a female, and it was fertile. Mm-hmm. And so that was really concerning. And so the need is to actually – this was halted when President Trump first came into office. He put a halt on the release of that study, and so we couldn't figure that out. And so we pushed to get that re-released, and then they did. And so it was released, and now it's open for – well, it was open for comment up until December 8th. And they had a series of plans or scenarios put in place, and then one of them was their preferred tentative plan – that they wanted to pursue. And so we've pushed them to go ahead and start implementing that plan. The plan is as good as the action. And so we're beyond the planning period. We think that will work. It involves increased type of barriers and multiple ways to prevent the fish from transiting between the Great Lakes. And so we're now at that stage where we want action. It's been stalled, though, because there's been quite a pushback from the shipping industry. And especially that barge industry that's along here. But the reality is, you know, you've got heavily subsidized industry that's a very small factor sort of holding the rest of the Great Lakes hostage. And so we are really pushing for what we think is a good there's consensus around this being valuable, both even for the shipping industry. We're not asking them to stop. It's just we're asking for more barriers. There's just a lot of fear there. So there's that, and then there's ballast water issues with shipping that goes across the Great Lakes, and that's the other primary issue with invasive species right now in terms of the Great Lakes.
Hmm. Big job, and it's a job that sort of never ends and sometimes shifts in terms of what your focus needs to be. We don't have too much time for this, unfortunately, but I know Dan was especially excited to hear from you some of what you do in terms of speaking in schools and talking to young people. That's a part of your mission, right?
Yes, a big part, especially here in Racine. So we have what is unique for us in the Great Lakes. We have a program where we target all students within a grade level. So at Racine Unified, this was the watershed program where we had students, all students in fourth grade at Racine Unified and all students in seventh grade. The students in fourth grade do a river program, learn about what the river's like in an area that's probably close to their neighborhood, very similar. And then in seventh grade, they go down to the beach and then understand, okay, what happened up there in the river now eventually happens here at the beach. And in seventh grade, kids are getting the freedom and thinking more about hanging out at the water and being by the water. And so it's important that we want them to understand what the value of this amazing, healthy beach we now have in Racine, because it wasn't like this. You know, just 10 years ago, you couldn't go to the beach and get clean water that said you could, you know, with a sign that said you could swim in it, you know, just a few years ago, and now you can. So we want kids to value that. We also want them to think about it from a safety factor so they understand the lake, they value it. And so now that program is somewhat split in that we decided to go and just to make it easier and more sustainable. Hawthorne Hollow is doing the fourth grade, and so that still will be river focused, and we're focusing more on the seventh grade, and we're calling now sort of the beach program. We may come up with a fancier name. We've brought in a new partner, the Great Lakes Community Conservation Corps. And they do a fantastic job working with youth, both young adults and older teenagers who learn some skill sets around environmental work, both from an emergency response standpoint as well as just a restoration. They literally will do everything from learning how to use a chainsaw to do, you know, emergency response to learning how to remove invasive species for restoration work. And they're in demand, and we've worked with them up in Sheboygan. Was the first time I worked with them. We brought them up to do educational program up there where we're helping the city basically create these dunes by planting dune grasses. That is actually a way to improve the habitat, but it also mitigates pollution. And we work with our students who worked with our students in stations, right? They would rotate with them, and they did some litter monitoring, and they helped them do some plantings. And they were singing songs, and they were connecting with the students on a different way. And I thought, this is really cool. So I'm really excited now to form this partnership with – the Great Lakes Community Conservation Corps, which is here in Racine. You know, this is unique. And it's a throwback to the ideas we used to have, these conservation corps back in the 30s. And the idea now being, how can we apply it to environmental awareness and hands-on restoration? And so, yeah, all this coming spring, we'll have typically around 1,500 seventh graders who will rotate through this beach program, which is about a half-day field trip. And really what we need to make that happen are volunteers. We'll both have the Great Lakes Community Conservation Corps and some of their guys working on it. But we like to maximize the hands-on approach. So it's a good – we like to have a good – educator to student ratio, so that every kid has a chance to ask a question, touch the bag, you know, use the temperature probe or do a dissolved oxygen test or do a bacteria test. And so we do that down at the beach. And the students at the end of the day learn sort of what it means to have a healthy beach. How do you assess that? And what are the potential impactors of that health? What, you know, what will cause this to go awry? And we have got a great learning laboratory here in Racine. Once again, unlike anywhere else, where we've got, you know, a lot of our stormwater down at North Beach and Zoo Beach gets filtered into a man-made wetland that slows the water down. It traps some of the pollutants before they actually get out to the water. And there's an overflow device there, too, when we have super heavy rains. So you can actually bring the students down, study the water, study the filtered water, and then study the unfiltered water. And all they have to do is look at those three bodies of water, and, like, learning happens. It's not in a textbook that talks about filtration of water or anything. They're actually there doing it, walking it, feeling it, testing it, touching it. And they start to think when we bring them down there and we show them where that outfall spits out into the wetland, and they see chip bags and they see oil sheen and they see, you know, big nasty algae, right away they start to go, huh, like, where's that coming from? And they usually, implicate themselves. They go, yeah, chip bag, that's us. Mm. So it's a powerful program. And like I said, one thing, if I could put a plug out, is we need volunteers. We need people who are willing to come down and help us deliver that programming so that kids can value what we all value as much.
Right. In the last minute or so, what else do you and the Alliance for the Great Lakes need from the people who are listening right now? What difference can we make for the better? 1 minute.
So volunteering. So as I just mentioned, either in our education programs, we also have what's called an Adopt-a-Beach program, which is we get out, we clean the beach, but we also gather data on the litter. And we do that because we're trying to build awareness for people about the different types of litter, where they come from, especially plastics. Hmm. And then we try to inform communities as well as policy in those issues. So that's a fun program that anyone can get involved in, and they need only just contact me, Todd Brennan, at our website, greatlakes.org. And beyond that, it's about people also being aware of their local impact. And if they want more learning on that local impact, to contact some of these local organizations like Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network is a great one that has plans they're implementing in all the different waterways. And thinking about every day, what am I doing and how's it impacting, especially when it comes to mowing your lawn and sweeping the grass clippings up versus into the street, and taking action when you see policies that come across. And when you think about voting, does your candidate want to put the protective policies in place for the Great Lakes? That's important for our leadership, really, overall. Are we holding them accountable to this thing that's super important to us and really breathes life into our community, both economically as well as socially? And so that's probably what I could tell people. GreatLakes.org, check us out, Adopt a Beach, or our volunteer program with youth, and then come to see us at different events. Echo Fest will happen this March again as part of the Greater Racine Water Council and the Green and Greater Racine Group. And so come and check us out there. We'll have a table there, and maybe we'll have an action step up for a policy like the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative or something, or you can just learn more about volunteering.
Fantastic. Todd Brennan from the Alliance for the Great Lakes, thank you so much for being here. This was an exciting and informative hour. Great to have you here.
Yeah, thank you, Greg, and Nan.
Nan, thanks.
It was wonderful.
Yeah, thanks for paying the invitation to him. What do you want to tell us about some events coming up?
I would like to tell you that the Southeast Gateway Group of Sierra Club is inviting everybody to their annual Christmas potluck on Thursday, December 21st, at 6 p.m. with a social hour beginning at 5 p.m. It'll be at the Sealed Air Family YMCA in Mount Pleasant. You have to bring your own place setting, which is a really cool thing to do, and a dish to pass. Non-alcoholic beverages are also welcome. They're going to have a little silent auction. It's going to be a white elephant silent auction, and so you can bring something to contribute as well. If you need more information, just contact Melissa Warner. You can do that by going to the Southeast Gateway Sierra Club's website or their Facebook page. We are having a winter break nature camp at River Bend on Tuesday, December 26th, Wednesday, December 27th, Thursday, December 28th, and Friday, December 29th, from 9 until 2 p.m., $30 per day for members, $35 per day for non-members. Ages are 7 to 13. They're going to do all kinds of amazing things. To get more information and to register, simply go to River Bend's Facebook page.